Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Gleave, who is an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Gleave.
Pleasure to be with you.
And let me begin by the caveat that I hesitate to talk. You know, there's been endless speculation, and a lot of it which is kind of ghoulish, about this aircraft disappearing, and one has to have empathy for that. The passengers, assuming everything that we've heard so far indicates a hijacking, and we don't know about their fate, and of course their next of kin are waiting, and perhaps with false hopes, because we don't know whether the plane landed and what's the fate of these people. So let's begin with that question. The fact that the plane, after it made this strange maneuver, went up to 45,000 feet above its ceiling, recommended ceiling, would that indicate that they were deliberately asphyxiating the passengers?
No, the likely cause is that they maybe when they're taking control of the airplane, they're trying to get the maximum range out of the aircraft. And by climbing higher and higher, they may be seeking to get more and more range out of the aircraft. It just becomes less controllable when it goes to its service ceiling. It just means that it can't climb quite at the rate that it normally has to comply with air traffic control clearances. So the 777 can fly very high anyway, but I wouldn't add too much at the moment to that in terms of considering asphyxiation of the passengers. The pressure will be fine inside the cabin, and then if there were a problem, the cabin masks would drop anyway, so the passengers would have about half an hour's worth of oxygen. But yes, I don't think that necessarily it's indicative just at this moment in time of trying to knock out potential hijackers, although it is one maneuver that can be used.
Well, we recall from the 9/11 tragedy that the aircraft that went down in Pennsylvania, the crew did take over. And, you know, obviously the questions arise if this plane was hijacked and if the pilots or some people aboard were complicit in this hijacking, then how did they subdue 200-plus passengers?
Well, it's a night flight. It's not a daytime flight across the United States. You don't have much in the way of visual references anyway because you're flying over the sea for quite a large period of time. It's not as dense as the United States is. So the first way of subduing the passengers is to put out an in-flight entertainment announcement saying they're terribly sorry, but certain functions don't work on the in-flight entertainment. And then you stop the moving map from working so the passengers don't know where they're going. That's the easy way to do it. And then after that, that will keep the passengers quiet for approximately the next 4 to 5 hours when they would then expect to be waking up heading for Beijing.
And questions about their personal cell phone or no evidence from cell phones, etc. How would you explain that?
Well, this is the hijackers, if it were to be a hijack, would obviously try and take off as many mobile phones off people as possible because they would be able to ping some of the ground stations and you'd get messages going backwards and forwards and being able to trace them. Obviously, they should be switched off. So it's more indicative of a takeover by somebody rather than a silent hijack. It's almost a silent hijack rather than a forced hijack. So this is why the psychological profiling of the crew is going on at the moment to see if they can find any evidence that any of the pilots was involved complicitly. Because then even some of the time when I've seen aircraft diverted, even the cabin crew don't realize where they're going to. So that would be the current theory that's being worked on with the highest probability of being correct.
So just, if you don't mind, David Gleave, tell me the difference between a silent hijacking and a forced hijacking.
Well, a forced hijacking would require people from the cabin to break through the cockpit door and then force the pilots to cooperate with their particular demands. We have had cases of crew hijacking recently, and we've also had cases of crew suicide recently. Now, in those cases, you don't need to, the passengers may not know what's happening or where they're going or what indeed their end fate is. So there'd be no reason for the passengers to suddenly start switching on mobile phones in the middle of the flight in order to try and get communication messages out as to where the aircraft was going. So So I think in this case, we tend to be looking towards a silent hijacking rather than a forced team of six people taking over the aeroplane with guns in Hollywood movie style.
Again, I'm speaking with David Glebe, who's an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK. So if this is the case, then if indeed it is a silent hijacking, the passengers aboard wouldn't have noticed then when the plane dropped down, apparently, to sea level. Is that according to the Malaysian radar tracking from Butterworth? That's my understanding.
Yes, I mean, the passengers wouldn't necessarily have noticed anything significant because you're really just listening to the rumble of the jet noise and the wind going past. So if it's been hijacked at night and you're over the sea, then you may see the odd flare from an oil rig or possibly some long-off distant city. But in general, it's very black, the middle of the South China Sea. So the passengers wouldn't necessarily be aware of anything in relation to altitude at all, because they have no form of visual reference to be able to work with, which is also why you need to isolate the in-flight entertainment system. Otherwise, one or two people on board the aeroplane are likely to be quite aviation enthusiasts and start to question why they're flying at 500 feet rather than 37,000 feet, as you would expect at that period of the flight.
So what is your understanding then, David Glebe, of this ambiguity over the satellite that picked up the last signals, and because it's a geostationary satellite over the equator, over the Indian Ocean, it gave according to the Malaysian Prime Minister, two possible routes. One is south into the Indian Ocean, which doesn't make any sense. There's no reason why you'd hijack a plane in order to crash it into the ocean and drown, you know, but the one to the north, well, you know, makes more sense because it went over land. So what do you make of that?
I think you need to do psychological profiling on the crew to make sure that there is no financial or political reason why they would hijack the aircraft and crash it into the sea. I have worked on crew suicides before. I'm not saying it is necessary here, but you'd certainly want to do the psychological profiling of the crew, and you can see that going on at the moment because they've raided their houses and they've taken the possessions away and they're looking through computer files and things like that to see if there's any reason that they would choose to act in this manner. But yes, we have to look at everything political, religious and financial at the moment. And that would explain a track that went off into the Indian Ocean, because if the aircraft is lost completely, you can't prove anything. And therefore, there may be a reason that if you desired the insurance payout, then that would be a reason for doing so, because obviously insurance companies don't pay out if you commit suicide. But if you can't prove that it's suicide, then this is the way to do it. We also have the curve that's being drawn is the edge of coverage from the particular satellite. So it may well have moved since that point. So it could well be quite a large area to the west or to the east, but probably to the west of those the curves that you see in the media being drawn at the moment. I think if it's gone north, it's very strange that we haven't heard from it in any form at all. We wouldn't expect to hear at this stage from the insurance companies if it had been hijacked and the airframe has been subjected to, say, a $50 million ransom before it was released. Nor would we necessarily expect to hear from the Chinese embassy that they were negotiating the release of 200 of their citizens for a ransom fee. But it's very very unusual that we haven't heard anything from any airport that they've had an aeroplane land unexpectedly, because obviously the whole world is looking for it. And you do need a reasonable size airport to not just land this aeroplane out, but actually to turn it around, refuel it and take it somewhere else. So the hijacking theory carries equal credibility for it. It's been stolen and hidden somewhere, or alternatively, it's been crashed into the Indian Ocean for suicidal reasons.
So, but who would the beneficiaries be of an insurance policy?
The previous case I worked on, it was the family were in. There was a degree of financial distress within the family, large medical bills needed paying, and also elements of a loss of face and a loss of status by the person that's been considered as the main person likely to have committed suicide with the aeroplane, in terms of downgrading their status within we have to remember this is Asian culture, not American culture, so we have to think slightly differently. But if you're going to lose your job or receive a significant demotion, then this can be the reason to be psychologically very upset because your status is being reduced. If you happen to die in a plane crash fighting the aircraft like a hero all the way to the ground, then your family retains that status, you receive the insurance payout, and you address all the other financial difficulties that you may have been having at the same time.
So if any of that is relevant, presumably that will be determined through psychological profiles of the crew. But what about going the northern route? I mean, one of the things that some people are afraid of is that this plane could end up being used later, by some kind of Al-Qaeda-type group, presumably a 777 Boeing laden fully with fuel and stacked to the gills with explosives could be an extraordinarily dangerous weapon.
Yes, indeed, but it's not... if you wanted to do something like that, this is a very complicated, quite high-risk way of doing things. If you were trying to take an aircraft as large as this and hide it, then it really is quite difficult to hide such a large thing from US intelligence satellites, Chinese intelligence satellites. And you need a big hangar to put it in. There's not that many hangars in the world are capable of housing a 777 if you were trying to land it and then park it. You would really want to know when the US spy satellites and the Chinese satellites were going overhead, the particular airfield you're trying to divert to make sure they weren't taking photographs, and then land it and then park it up, say, at times when the satellites weren't overhead. So an awful lot of intelligence-related planning is required to be able to do that. The aircraft needs 60 meters or 200 feet to be able to turn itself around. So you can't land it on just any particular tiny strip. It does need quite a wide turning circle and taxiways and things like that to be able to undertake this plan. And certainly I've seen aircraft stolen in the past to be used as freighters for drugs, but it would certainly be a very daring way of doing things to take over an aircraft this size. But there are aircraft that you could effectively just charter or buy out of the desert, which are as big as this, if you wanted to achieve the same objectives.
So this is a little bit too elaborate, you think, for that kind of scenario?
I think it's quite an elaborate scenario, particularly when you start to need to track US spy satellite flyover times and things like that. It can be done, but it would require an awful lot of intelligence planning to be able to do so.
That would imply, a state intelligence. The only country that would be subject to that kind of speculation would be Pakistan, where the plane apparently, it's one of the countries that it could have gone towards or over. That is a country that does have state-sponsored terrorism, but there again, that's a pretty militarized neighborhood, isn't it?
Indeed, and you would have seen, the Indians would have seen something. In order to get to Pakistan, it would have to go... or it may have gone close to India. And again, there's not that many places in Pakistan where you can actually hide this size of aircraft, because if you said it's gone to Pakistan, there's probably, I don't know exactly, but there's probably only two or three hangars within the entire country that are capable of housing such an aircraft. And then you have to use remote sensing technology on board the satellites to look inside the hangar to see whether it was actually there at the time. So, for example, if it's been flown there deliberately and you have spy satellites circling that area, you would look for infrared signatures of an aircraft of this size and see if the engines are still hot in the hangar if you can.
So
you would try and do so.
Sure. So, David Gleave, again, an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK. So I take it then, the most likely scenario, well, you mentioned the possibility of a suicide insurance scenario. What about a criminal scenario? I mean, you mentioned that. What would the advantage be? I mean, we're talking about $50 million. If you ransomed out all of the passengers to the Chinese, I believe there were 153 Chinese, including a high-level delegation of Chinese artists aboard the plane. So presumably $1 million each, you get a substantial amount of money there, right?
Yes, I mean, we've got to look at the type of ransom demands that are paid in Somalia when the pirates hijack oil ships and things like that. A new one of these aircraft is something of the reach of $250 million. This aircraft's about halfway through its life, so it's worth something like $100 million or so. So it's worth paying $50 million to get it back. However, it's been quite a long time since anybody has successfully hijacked an aircraft. Normally, you know, because it's diverted to a major civilian airport because it needs to be refueled to get to a country which you may be able to be in control, like Somalia or something like that. So it would be quite a daring attempt to have somewhere to land this aircraft and then from there to ransom it for $50 million. And it could just be for piracy purposes or indeed just as a form of getting funds for more terrorist activities. But whatever the reason, we would have expected to have found the aircraft by now if it had just landed somewhere at a normal airfield or even a military airfield or a disused airfield or anything like that. But it is, as you said earlier, is a very, very wide landmass area to search over. But certainly everybody in the world is looking for it.
Well, just in closing then, David Glebe, what's your understanding of why the Malaysian government behaved in such an odd and apparently inept way? The Chinese government and, of course, the Chinese next of kin of the missing passengers are furious. Why, you know, the Malaysian Air Force had these radar tracks, I believe, last Wednesday from Butterworth, where they, you know, somehow there was, but they wasted a whole week in the wrong ocean, searching the wrong ocean.
Well, yes, I mean, we had the report to the primary radar tracks. But if the military then have to coordinate with the civilian service, they want to give out real facts. And I doubt that they have the software and the teams capable of processing the radar picture and actually working out that it's a 777. They can say it's a large return, but it takes a degree of sophisticated processing, which is normally associated with military design of stealth aircraft, to work out what the cross-section is of the aeroplane that's reflected back by the radar and compare that with what you actually have measured. And yes, it was. We know that now that we think it's flown off to the west for an hour, but there's nothing to stop it having turned around and come back again. I think the most important thing was to search around the position of last contact and say, okay, we know, we're fairly confident it's not here. And you have to work on several theories at once. Certainly the Malaysian government have been releasing information as they know it. And there are always time delays when you have, for example, you have British investigators sort of 8 hours behind Malaysia. You have American investigators sort of 16 hours behind Malaysia and then Malaysian time. So if you ask for technical help and it has to go back to the headquarters of any particular organization, it can take a day for the response to come back again, purely because this is a global situation that we're looking at.
So you wouldn't be too hard on the Malaysian authorities then?
Well, I think we also have to say that when you start to get politicians looking at things who are subject to being elected and also subject to a culture where a loss of face is the thing you try to avoid, then I understand the behaviour, but from a Western perspective, we may find it a little bit strange.
Well, David Glebe, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with David Glebe, who is an aviation safety expert with the Transport Studies Group at Loughborough University in the UK. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.